Well, good morning. This morning, what I'd like to attempt to do, at least, not making any promises, give you an overview of the entire book of Revelation. Now, most people shy away from it. A lot of people don't like to teach it. Some think it's sensational. Others think it's too complicated. Some say there's too many views, so how do you pick the right one? But really, I think it's one of the most wonderful, in fact, I consider it one of the most important books of the entire Bible. So I'd like to give you a little bit of an overview, and the two things, actually, within the overview, I'd like to kind of insert kind of my analysis, if you will, kind of in broad strokes, of what we might expect knowing what we know in the book of Revelation that will, in fact, take place. Now, I want to distinguish. These are not fulfillments. There are some that look at the scriptures and claim fulfillments. There's really only one major fulfillment, and that was the reestablishment of the nation of Israel in 1948. But apart from it, I think most of the other passages are still future from our time frame. So these are not fulfillments, but my analysis in terms of what we can anticipate. And if you've got an outline sheet, did everybody get an outline sheet? What I've got is an exegetical outline, in other words, giving the structure and the content of the passages themselves, the book of Revelation. And interspersed in it is an outline within an outline, and that's kind of my analysis that you can see from the little note there at the top there. And I was going to do this in one session, and the more I thought about it, I thought, well, probably too much. So I'm going to break it down, and I'm scheduled to come back. I can't remember exactly when, but we'll do part two the next time. Lord willing, he may come in between, obviously. So, one of the most important books of the entire Bible, and the heart of it, and the essence of the book, deals with the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. Now, John writes, using phraseology like this one here, you might say, what is that? Where does that come from? Well, the book of Revelation is the last book of the Bible, right? You know that. John assumes that you've read the Bible. John assumes that you have some familiarity with the scriptures. And in the first century, the major scriptures were the Old Testament. So he takes phrases like the Lion of the Tribe of Judah all the way to the book of Genesis. In fact, I'm going to read a passage where it's contained. And he uses them. And some of them, like this is a messianic phrase that anticipates the coming of the Messiah. Book of Revelation, the essence of it is the coming of the Messiah. In other words, Jesus Christ as the Messiah, the ultimate one that God sends. That's what the book is all about. And the book tells us coming soon. So we'll look at that. So in my outline here, we can break it down. I've got three major divisions. You try to break books up into divisions. Even shorter books might have two or three, not a whole lot. I see three in the book of Revelation. I break down the first three chapters, the vision of Jesus Christ among the seven churches. Structurally, I see them connected and related, and if we had more time, I could show you that, but I'm just giving you an overview. And at the very beginning, we have an introduction, introduction, two parts, a prologue and a benediction. First eight verses, and that leads us to the very first verse. And obviously, I can't give you a lot of background here because I'm giving you just an overview, just the high points of the entire book. But with the very first word, the revelation, including the article there, that's the essence of what we have here. This is a revelation, an unveiling. Apocalypsis is the Greek word there, where we get another word that sounds similar. What do we sometimes call it, the apocalypse. That's where the name comes from the Greek word. It's an unveiling or a revealing or an uncovering. So the book of Revelation gives us lots of things that are new, a lot that is not new, but put in a different way and organized uniquely in the book of Revelation, such that it is a revelation. And what's most important, it's a revelation of Jesus Christ. Also notice it's singular. So the book is viewed as a revelation. Some people call it revelations, plural, but that's inaccurate. It's a revelation of Jesus Christ. He's the heart of it. So it's unveiling things about Jesus Christ, in some cases, that are not revealed anywhere else. Some call it a fifth gospel. The four gospels give us the earthly ministry of Jesus Christ from four different perspectives, four different audiences. The book of Revelation gives us another perspective on the Lord Jesus Christ. It's a picture of the resurrected Christ, not the earthly ministry, but the resurrected Christ. And it's about him. Now, the of there, it's a genitive in the Greek. It could be possessive. In other words, this is the revelation that belongs to Christ, or it's about Christ, or contained within Christ. And I think all of those are possibilities, but primarily it's a revelation concerning Christ. So we're going to see some things about Christ that when they're placed or when they're discussed elsewhere, they're put together in a unique way so that we have something of a chronology even, I believe, which God gave him, so it belongs to him, possessive. So I think that idea is there. The revelation belonging to Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his bondservants, doulos, the things which must take place. In other words, divine necessity, a little Greek word there, giving the idea that these things are not optional. They're not possibilities, but these things must take place because they're part of the plan of God. In fact, the book of Revelation gives us the completion of world history from God's perspective. The completion of God's plan. So these things must, and he says soon, and I think the idea here, I won't get into the detail, but imminently. In other words, it could have been expected. And believers in the first century anticipated, and some of them, including Paul, in 1 Thessalonians, when he's describing the rapture, he says we are anticipating it, basically. So believers in the first century anticipated the soon coming in the sense of imminent. It could happen at any time. And there was nothing that needed to be fulfilled before his return. So that's the case even 2,000 years later, soon take place. And he sent and communicated it by his angel to his bondservant, John. So here's a specific bondservant, John, and he's the author. And he testified to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. So there are several individual visions that are part of this broader revelation. And he's basically telling us things that he saw. We'll see that in some of the verses. So I probably spend a little bit more time on that verse than I will any of the others, just to kind of get us into the book here. So first division, the vision of Jesus Christ among the seven churches, three chapters, prologue and benediction, first eight verses. And then the bulk of chapter one deals with this vision of the resurrected Christ. And it is so spectacular that John really doesn't have words to describe it. In fact, I call it indescribable. And that's verses 9 through 20. And before you get to verse 20, there's a little verse in there that kind of gives you an outline of the book of Revelation. I call it a chronological outline because it lays out the chronology. What I have on your outline sheet is more the structural outline, if you will, or exegetical outline. So he says in verse 19, therefore, after he saw the vision, and he falls on his face as a dead man, The Lord comforts him and tells him, fear not. And then verse 19, therefore write. So he's instructed to record basically what he saw. And what is he to write? Write the things which you have seen, past tense. And if you're reading through the book of Revelation, the things that he have seen is the vision. So he records chapter 1, essentially, the vision of the Lord Jesus Christ. And the things which are, what's the tense of that verb? Present tense. In other words, the things that were going on in the time frame of John and on the occasion that John is starting to write. And he's talking about the seven churches that are contained in chapters 2 and 3. And then he says, and the things which will take place after these things, what are these things referring to? The things that are. So the things that are, if they pertain to the church age, he's also going to describe things after the church age, the things which will take place after these things. And that gives us the broad chronology of the book of Revelation. Chapter 1, dealing with things that John had already seen, the vision. Chapters 2 and 3, things that are taking place during the church age. And then after the church age, in chapter 4, he's going to begin things in the future. And all of these things, I take, are even future from our time frame because we're still in the church age. Make sense? So pretty simple outline. We can chart it on a timeline here. The cross represents the crucifixion. And in 95 is the writing, the date of writing that I take the book. So around 95, John receives a vision. These are the things you have seen. So they pertain to what John has seen. And then there's a church age that we're still part of that began on the day of Pentecost. Those are the things which are. And that's why I call it a temporal or a chronological outline here. And then the things that take place after the church age, that would be after the rapture. So that begins chapter 4, and that extends all the way to the end of the book. And I put chapter 22 beyond a millennial kingdom because he's going to talk about things pertaining to eternity as well. So these are the things that will take place after these things. So you have a temporal or a chronological outline that Jesus himself gives. And some commentators use that as the outline of the book, and I think it's a good one. But I prefer to give the structure and how things relate to one another, and that's what I've got on your outline sheet. So chapters 2 and 3 deal with the seven churches. And these are messages, much like what you would read, the writings of Paul. The uniqueness is that these are from Jesus Christ himself. So Paul writes to the Thessalonians. Paul writes to the Philippians. Paul writes to the Ephesians. And Jesus also sends a little letter to the church at Ephesus. So this is 2 Ephesians. Well, maybe not. 1 Ephesians from Jesus Christ. And what he's doing in these seven churches is he's evaluating. They're like inspection reports that relate to the church or various churches in particular locations. So these letters are just similar. They're epistolary, you might call them. They're similar to those that Paul or Peter or Jude or the other writers that send letters. They pertain to a particular group of people in a particular location that are involved in a church at that location. And he is evaluating them, Jesus is, from his divine perspective. Most of them have negative aspects. Some of them, most of them also have positive, and he calls attention to them. It's kind of like an inspection report. At Ephesus, the main problem, and this is what he wants them to correct, is they have left their first love. So something has declined since Ephesians. Ephesians is very positive, the one that Paul writes. But by 95 AD, now Ephesians would have been written in the 60s, I think. Right around, about 60, actually, at the end of the book of Acts, essentially. And now we're 35 years later, and there's been a decline. They've left their first love. Now, there's lots to commend, but there's also this problem. Then he writes to a church that is under persecution. It's a purified church, and there's no complaint, just positive things. And by the way, these are also characteristics of churches that exist throughout the church age. They're pertaining to things which are, in other words, things that not just first century. Now, these are particular, but just like you can read Ephesians today, and it would be applicable to the church today as well. You can read these in the same way and find application to particular churches. And in some cases, there are churches that are compromised, like the church at Pergamum. We can find that in Albuquerque and elsewhere around the country. So you can apply these much like you apply the others as well. Church at Thyatira, they were tolerating apostasy. And there's churches that do that. Sardis, he calls it a dead church. So predominantly, it's a church made up of unbelievers. Now, within it, he also talks about some have not soiled their garments. So there's a few, small number, that are probably born-again believers. But many of them are walking in the flesh. So the essence of that church, it's a dead church. No spiritual life. And then there's the church at Philadelphia, which is another very positive one. It's a very faithful church. He opens a door of opportunity of ministry, even though of all of the churches, this is the smallest and most insignificant. Yet they have the greatest opportunity because of their faithfulness. Then there's the church at Laodicea, a lukewarm church. And some churches have that as a characteristic. Now, you can look at these characteristics of churches, but you can also look and evaluate your individual life and find application as well. So that's the vision of Jesus Christ among the seven churches, first three chapters. The bulk of the book deals with a period of time that there's a lot of detail in the Old Testament. In fact, we have the chronology for it in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 9 lays out what some describe as Daniel's 70th week. There are 70 weeks of years. 69 of them were fulfilled preceding the coming of the Messiah. And when Jesus came, there's a gap between the 69th and the 70th week. And the Bible, in the Old Testament, several passages, not only Daniel, but Isaiah, Jeremiah, and most of the prophets will describe a period of time. Jeremiah calls it the time of Jacob's trouble. Very descriptive terms where Israel and the people of God are under persecution. So it's a period of tribulation. The bulk of the book deals with that 1 week of years, a seven-year period of time. Book of Revelation and Book of Daniel as well divides it into two parts. And from chapters 4 through chapter 18, all of those chapters describe that period of time. I believe that we're not in that period of time. So everything that it deals with looks forward to the future, even from our day right now. But things don't just automatically turn on and off. Things sometimes gradually move. And what I see is the possibility, and I'm putting that out, these are not fulfillments, the possibility we may be seeing pieces coming together, setting the stage for what will in the future be fulfilled, beginning in chapter 4 through chapter 18. So I title that The Tribulation from Jesus Christ, and I keep it together. That's why I'm using a structural outline to keep the main topics, if you will, or the main discussion together. The vision of Jesus Christ among the seven churches, there's an interrelationship there between those three chapters, and I see chapters 4 through 18 all relating to a particular time frame that has specific boundaries. And then the rest of the book, which is really just a few chapters, 19 through 22, I call it the consummation by Jesus Christ. By consummation, God is bringing everything to a conclusion, to a consummation, to a fulfillment. And it includes a lot of judgment, but it also includes positive things in terms of the coming of the Messiah. So the consummation anticipates the second coming of Jesus Christ, and then it describes what he's going to do in that coming. So in this exegetical outline, the way I break it down, it's not too much different, but it's just slightly different in that I see the first three chapters, the vision of Jesus Christ among the seven churches, and then this period of tribulation broken down into two 3.5-year periods, and something significant happens in the middle that Daniel calls out. Jesus alludes to the same thing in his outline of prophetic scriptures, what's called the Olivet Discourse. He pinpoints this event as well. So there's two halves, and throughout the book, attention is called to one or the second of the 3.5 years. In fact, we'll read some passages that call that out. So this period is very clearly defined, and I think the book of Revelation is describing a particular period of time. And then we have the consummation, and then again, the word goes beyond the millennial kingdom. I see the millennial kingdom as part of world history. And at the end of it, there's a last event of world history, the Great White Throne Judgment. And then you go into eternity. And I see chapters 21 and 22 describing the eternal state. That's why I have it going a little bit past the kingdom line there. So that's 19 through 22. You see the structure I've got here? So the book is not that complicated in terms of the way it's laid out. In fact, one scholar says the book of Revelation is not hard to understand. It's hard to believe because of the scope of everything that is described. So that's your broad outline. In fact, we could stop here and I could say we finished our overview of the whole book of Revelation, right? Well, let me add a little detail. Maddie won't let me go. Three chapters, vision of Jesus Christ among the seven churches, the tribulation from Jesus Christ. Remember, this is a revelation of Jesus Christ, so he's involved in this seven-year period. In fact, he's going to orchestrate, we'll see that in chapter 6. He's the one that is bringing many of the judgments. He's the one that is the judge and will, in fact, execute judgment. So 4 through 18, we can break it down. And I see chapters 4 through 7, I group them together because this theme of a seven-sealed book seems to run through all seven chapters. And then chapter 8, we have a different set of judgments that I think kind of organize that material there. So let's take a look at 4 through 7. And we have the origin of the scroll, which is the focus, in chapters 4 and 5, and issues relating to the origin. And it's a scene in heaven. So the origin is from heaven. That's why these things must take place. This is part of the divine plan that God has set up. So the scene, John makes it clear at the beginning of verse 1 of chapter 4, and notice the little phrase. It's identical what Jesus said in verse 19. The things that will take place after these things. Notice how it starts. After these things. Identical. I looked. Remember, these are visions that John is seeing, individual visions, part of the one revelation. I looked and behold, a door standing open in heaven. So he's looking up and sees a door and he sees heaven. God opens up heaven and gives him a vision of heaven. A door standing open in heaven, and the first voice which I heard, like the sound of a trumpet speaking with me, said, come up here. So John is called up essentially to view this heavenly scene, and apparently he goes through a door, or at least he sees something that represents a door. So come up here. Now, this is very similar to the rapture. Now, the rapture pertains to the church. The book of Revelation, except for the first three chapters, does not deal with the church. In fact, after chapter 3, the word church no longer occurs in the book of Revelation until you get to the conclusion where John is instructed to send this message to the seven churches that were described in chapters 2 and 3. The book of Revelation does not, or beginning in chapter 4, does not deal with the church. That's why I don't think that this is a picture of the rapture, even though John experienced kind of like a prelude to it, or analogous to a rapture. He is taken up in a heavenly scene. But what he sees is more than likely what the church will see when we go to be with the Lord. Does that make sense? So when you read the book of Revelation, don't insert the church in it after chapter 3. Israel and the Old Testament description of the people of God, that is the focus. And that's the purpose of this period of 7 years. This is Daniel's 70th week. The 69 pertain to the nation of Israel, and so does the 70th. So think Jewish when you read chapters 4, in fact, to the end of the book. That's why I say world history is Jewish. God is not done with the nation of Israel. You've heard me talk about this before. And here is the consummation of God's work with the nation of Israel, where Paul says all of Israel shall be saved. And it'll happen during this 7-year period of time. So the things which must take place after, he repeats it, after these things, tying it back to verse 19. Then verse 2, immediately I was in the Spirit. So he is seeing visions in the Spirit. And behold, a throne, and that's the emphasis of chapter 4, was standing in heaven. Notice it's a heavenly scene. And one sitting on the throne. And the focus of chapter 1 is this personage that is indescribable, using what John sees, visionary language, to describe probably God the Father, because in chapter 5 we're going to have the Lamb or the Son. So we have the Father and the Son pictured here. And John is in the Spirit, if you will. So one sitting on the throne, and everything proceeds from the throne. And then when you get to chapter 5, I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne, after describing him, and great worship, by the way. In fact, the book of Revelation is one of the most worshipful of all of the books of the Bible. And that's one of its values, is to bring out and teach us about worship. And chapter 4, chapter 5 is full of worship. In fact, the whole book is full of worship. So I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a book. Now you could translate it scroll. That's the Greek word there. It's actually a scroll. And most documents were written on a scroll, or most writings of the first century. And it's written inside on and on the back, so it's a complete book. Sealed up with seven seals. So you'd have a seal. You can imagine a roll of parchment. And then you have these seals that seal it. And this is described here. That's why I see this dealing, because this is kind of the climax of the heavenly part where John sees this scroll. That's the focus. That's why I called it the seven seal scroll, beginning in chapter 4. And then if you skip down to verse 4 and 5, then I began to weep greatly because there was no one that could open the seals. Seven seals, and there's no one that can open, because all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So no one was found worthy to open the book or to look into it. Oh no, what are we going to do? And then one of the elders that is described in chapter 4, which probably represents the church in that heavenly scene, like I said, it's not describing the rapture, but what takes place after. These elders, one of the elders said to me, "Stop weeping, behold," and here's the phrase, "the lion that is from the tribe of Judah," that's a messianic term, and in this context it makes it clear that it's Jesus Christ. And a second title, "the root of David has overcome." He's the sinless one. He's overcome sin. John tells us in the Gospel and 1 John, he has overcome not only sin, but he's overcome the world, and he's paid the payment for sin. He has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals. So now we've found someone, and now the rest of the chapter is worshiping the lion that is from the tribe of Judah. So that's the heavenly scene and the origin of this seven-seal scroll. And now, beginning chapter 6, this lion from the tribe of Judah is going to break the seals and open them one at a time. And in chapter 6, we have the first six seal judgments. And verse 1, chapter 6, "Then I saw when the Lamb..." The Lamb is the same personage as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Now, John assumes that you read his gospel, like I said, and he identifies the Lamb that takes away the sins of the world, viewing his sacrifice as a lamb, unblemished lamb that would die on the cross. In fact, the word lamb is used like 28 times in the book of Revelation. This is the most common description of the Lord Jesus Christ, so that we see it's the same personage. Yes, he's the Messiah. Yes, he's the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Yes, he's of the root of David. Yes, he is the fulfillment of all of these other Old Testament messianic pictures, but he's the same one that died on the cross. He's the same one that was the sacrificial lamb. And notice it's the lamb that breaks one of the seven seals. "And I heard one of the four living creatures," these are angelic creatures, don't have time to get into that, "saying, as with a voice of thunder, come." And then John sees the result of the opening, verse 2. "I looked and behold," and what does John see? He sees a white horse. Now, some commentators mix this up with chapter 19, when the Messiah comes on a white horse, and there's some similarities. This is a warrior. This is a powerful personage. White horse, and he who sat on it had a bow. So he's a conqueror. He's a military personage. And a crown. He's a ruler. He's a king. And a crown was given to him. This is pretty emphatic in the Greek text. In other words, he doesn't act on his own. He must be given permission, given authority. And the implication here is the Lamb is giving him authority to perform certain actions. And he can only act within certain parameters. It is given to him. He can't go beyond them. So a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Now, this is not the one that rides the white horse in chapter 19. This is a counterfeit. He looks like him. He acts like him. And in fact, we'll see in the book of Revelation and elsewhere, he claims to be him. He claims to be a savior or a messianic figure, a very powerful individual that'll take control of the whole world. So the first seal is a coming of a messianic personage, or one that is a counterfeit, and he will in fact conquer, and he will rise to world prominence and essentially control the entire world for a period of time until God is through using him in terms of the plan of God here. So in our outline, we have six seals, chapter 6, and they're laid out. Scholars relate the, there's three sets of judgments. There's seal judgments, there's trumpet judgments, and there's bowl judgments. And scholars relate them differently, and I'm talking about solid Bible teaching scholars. And one set, and I incline in this direction, I see chapter 6 as kind of an outline of judgments that take place throughout the seven-year period of time. And I've got lots of reasons for that. We don't have time to get into it. But I just want to call attention. There are some that see them sequentially. In other words, the seal judgments, and then the trumpet judgments, and then the bowl judgments. But I see the first six seal judgments as kind of a panoramic or a preview of the entire 7 years. So I see them parallel rather than sequential. I'll show you that as we move through the chart here. So we have six seal judgments that give a picture of the entire 7 years. And in fact, I see the first 11 chapter, or 4 through 11, as dealing with primarily events, the major events surrounding these major judgments. Now, beginning in chapter 12, the emphasis is going to change, and I'll show you that when we get to that point. So what can we expect? What can we anticipate? I think what we are seeing today may be setting the stage for the rising up of an individual. He will not come until I think the church is gone. But he's not just going to just poof his here. He's going to be born. He's going to live a life. And he's going to perhaps even in some way gain some power or some recognition. But I think what we are seeing today, and I think it's going to degenerate in this whole area of leadership. Today, we have a leadership vacuum, very much so in our country. In fact, I don't want to give you a lot of details and get very political here, but I don't think Biden is really the actual president of our country today. I think he's more of a puppet. Now, that's all I'll say. I won't get into all the details and all the politics there. But this is typical, and we don't know. In fact, we have a leadership vacuum in our country, and I think this is the case worldwide. You might anticipate. What I would anticipate is not, in other words, don't put your faith necessarily on a man. I think we're going to have a continuing and an increase leadership vacuum, that this spectacular individual rises to power and captures the world and is messianic, and the world says, ah, finally we have a leader. Finally we have somebody that has solutions. Finally we have somebody that has power. And the whole world is actually going to follow after him. So that's about all I want to say on it. Also, and I'm amazed today at the level of deception, and I'm talking not just in the unbelieving world. In fact, our country is divided basically in half, and I think there's a large amount of deception in terms of one of the halves. I think the other half has more clarity in terms of truth, but there's a lot of deception out there in the unbelieving world, all kinds of confusion, all kinds of different ways to God, they say, spiritual deception. And what we can anticipate is this is going to increase, because one of the main features of this seven-year period of time is this tremendous deception. Let me read just one passage outside of the book of Revelation. And this is talking about this leader that will, in fact, deceive the whole world into believing that he is the Messiah. Verse 8, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8. Then that lawless one, in fact, most of the chapter deals with a description of this leader. We call him Antichrist. That's what John calls him. That lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth. So he's giving assurance that he's going to have his end. And bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. In other words, the coming of the Lord. He's going to slay him. That is, the one whose coming is in accordance with the activity of Satan. A lot of demonic, a lot of satanic activity during the 7-year period. With all power and signs and false wonders. He's going to be a miracle worker. And through miracles, he's going to deceive the world. So just because somebody can perform a miracle doesn't mean they're from God. False prophets can do it. And this individual in that first seal is going to be the greatest of probably all the deceivers. And he's going to perform miracles. And with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. So in other words, they've heard the truth, but they've rejected it. And now God is going to, in a divine way, impose deception. Verse 11. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they might believe what is false. Now that, I think, takes place during that 7-year period. Great deception. In fact, we cannot even imagine it, but I think we are seeing the precursors of it. And we see a lot of demonic activity. In fact, that's another thing I've got on the list here. And a lot of satanic deception, not just in the unbelieving world, but in the churches as well. There's a lot of false doctrine out there, a lot of deception, and don't expect it to lessen. I think it'll increase, so I've got it on the list here. And along with all of that, we're going to see a cultural decline, and there's no doubt that we are in deep cultural decline as a country, and this is worldwide as well. And this will continue to a crisis point, and this crisis point is what this great deceiver, the messianic figure or antichrist, will in fact utilize to propel himself to power. So that's the seven seals and the opening. You can read the other six. They deal with things that take place on earth. And then chapter 7, from the divine perspective, what God is doing a work as well on earth, but it originates from heaven. And you could read the whole chapter, but let's read a few selected verses here, 3 and 4. And obviously it's even in the middle of a sentence, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants." Instructions to angelic messengers. In fact, you can develop an entire angelology from the book of Revelation. God sends angels. He utilizes them. They're involved in judgments. They're involved in all kinds of things. And here, notice they have a mission to these bondservants. And the implication is angels are bringing some of the harm, which are the judgments, but they're told to wait. And we have a time frame here. Let's see. Maybe not this verse, but in the time frame, I think verses 1 and 2 gives us, I think at the beginning, it gives us the first 3.5 years, and it's at the beginning of that 3.5 years that this takes place. Before the judgments come. So it's kind of going back to the very beginning, and they're holding back the judgments until these bondservants are sealed, a special group of individuals. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. They're Jewish. And then following, beginning of verse 5 through most of the rest of the chapter, actually through verse 8, we have 12 tribes, so 12,000 from 12 tribes. Now, one of the tribes is left out, but I don't want to get into that detail as well. 144,000. And I take all of the numbers, and I've studied all of the numbers in the book of Revelation, and I take all of them literally. I couldn't find a single one that would be taken symbolically or non-literally. So there's going to be 144,000. I think they are the diaspora, perhaps the diaspora that exists today of Jewish people, they will be converted at the very beginning. Now, it doesn't tell us how. There's a later chapter that I think gives us how it happens. I'll get to that in a moment if we have time. I'm not going to complete what we started here, but we'll go for a few more minutes here. But there's going to be 144,000, and I think they are spread throughout the world, so they don't have to go to mission school and learn all the languages because they're raised in these cultures. And there'll be 12,000 from each tribe spread out throughout the world. They will be God's evangelists. This is the only thing positive in this period of horrific judgments, is massive conversions, first beginning with 144,000 Jews. These are part of the Jews that Paul describes in Romans 11 when he says all Israel will be saved. This will be the instrumentality that God uses, God's evangelists. And they will spread the gospel and share it. In verse 9, we have the results of their missionary work. And by the way, the greatest missionary effort was not the 18th and 1900s, not Billy Graham, but the greatest missionary effort will be by the 144,000 during the Great Tribulation. So it still is yet future. So there's still hope. And by the way, this is the only positive. And then verse 9, John sees another vision. After these things, I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation, not just Israel. This is the product. This is the result of the evangelism of 144,000. And all tribes and peoples and tongues. It would include Israel, but it goes beyond Israel. It would include all nations, all tribes, all peoples. And notice they're standing before the throne. So a lot of them have died. And now they're before that heavenly throne that we saw in chapter 4. And before the Lamb. There's another reference to Jesus Christ, the Lamb. And they're clothed in white robes. They have been justified. They're righteous. That's the picture of white robes. And palm branches were in their hands. They've got salvation. But they're dead. They're martyrs. And the fifth seal judgment is great martyrdom that takes place. So if you become a believer during the tribulation, most of the believers will die for their faith, except the 144,000 because they're sealed. Does that make sense? So this is the result, and you can read on the rest. We have more description of this great multitude that includes Jew and Gentile and a great revival. God is bringing the final group of people in preparation for his second coming and a millennial kingdom. So chapter 8 through 11 focuses on the trumpet judgments. And I think I'll just give you a little bit of it, and then that'll be a good place to stop. So 8 through 11, trumpet judgments. And the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound them. So we have angels again. And they have seven trumpets, and these trumpets are like announcing the coming of these judgments. They're prepared to sound them. The first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth. In fact, the first four trumpet judgments are in thirds, and a destruction on the earth. I mentioned the book of Revelation is not hard to believe, or hard to understand. It's hard to believe the scale. We're talking about a scale, continental scale, a third. It'd be like an entire continent being obliterated. Now, I'm not saying that a continent is obliterated, but it's that scale in terms of all the world. There came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. In one of the other judgments that we saw, a quarter of all of humanity dies as a result of some of these judgments. A quarter of all of humanity, one of the seal judgments. If there are 8 billion people, we're talking about 2 billion people die in one judgment. Later on, another third, So if two die, two billion die, that leaves 6 billion. And a third of it is what? Another 2 billion. So in two judgments, half of all of the population of the world dies. Unimaginable. And this is what we are describing in these judgments. So I see the seals as a panorama of the 7 years. And then sometime after some of the seal judgments, and we don't have a time frame, so we can't be certain on it. Now we have, I think, in parallel, trumpet judgments on top of some of the remaining seal judgments. Now, like I said, some scholars see them sequentially, so you can decide on your own. So chapters 8 and 9 describe specifically these trumpet judgments. And then again, a reminder, we're emphasizing events. Now, skip to chapter 9 because these are very severe, more severe than the seal judgments. Then a fifth angel sounded. So now we've skipped to number 5. And I saw a star from heaven, which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. So it's a personage. Even though the word for star is the same one for those that are heavenly body stars. So we have a personage, and there's the description supports that. So we have a personage here. He has the key of the bottomless pit, or the abyss, some translations translate it. And he opened the bottomless pit, and then out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth, and power was given. Remember, John is seeing these things, and he's doing the best that he can to describe them. So they're like locusts upon the earth, and power was given them as the scorpions of the earth have power. Skip to verse 4 and 5. And they were told not to hurt the grass or the earth. So these are strange locusts. I mean, that's food for locusts, but these are different. And do not, but only, in other words, hurt only the men who do not have the seal. That's 144,000. The seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not permitted to kill anyone. In other words, they're just torturing them. Now, I interpret these as demonic spirits. They may be men that are demon-possessed, an entire army of them going throughout the earth tormenting people. But torment them for 5 months. So I think it's literal. And their torment was like the torment, see the likeness here, the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. So tremendous suffering, great destruction in not only the seal judgments, but now the trumpet judgments. And there's a couple of things that I think that we can anticipate and expect. We can anticipate and expect an increase in satanic activity. It's not going to just turn on during the 7 years. I think it's going to build up, and then it's going to manifest itself in full bloom during the 7 years. But we can anticipate it, and I see it all around us. A lot of satanic, a lot of demonic activity. The whole drug scene, there's a lot of demonic activity in that. And there's overt Satan worship today. In fact, there's a Church of Satan in Albuquerque and in most of the major cities. And it's increasing. Witchcraft is popular in some circles. You can anticipate this to increase, and you'll see the full-blown effect. In other words, they're not fulfillments, but anticipating what will come during the 7 year. And we can anticipate an increase in terrorism, just tormenting of people, that people inflict all kinds of evil on fellow man. And we can expect it to increase. In fact, another little political thing, there are terrorist cell groups in our country right now that have come across the border in the last few years. And some believe that they're just organizing for something very similar to a 9/11. So you can anticipate that. Don't be surprised if it happens. Well, that's the trumpet judgments. And then beginning in chapter 12, and I think I'll end here. We'll pick this up when we come back. Chapters 12 through 14 is a heavenly explanation. And it begins with laying out the main characters. So you can read ahead and read chapters 12 and 13, where we have the main characters that are the main players during this seven-year period of time. Now, there's a little bit of symbolism there, but you can interpret it using the information from the text itself. In fact, the text interprets very clearly who the dragon is, and some of the others you can find in the Old Testament. So let me skip to my final slide here. And we'll close in a word of prayer. One of the things that you should be impressed with during your reading of the book of Revelation is God is acting and doing things that must take place, indicating he is sovereign over all of these things. The Lamb is active. God sends angels to do certain things. God raises up people like the 144,000 to accomplish his purposes. And if he can do that on this worldwide scale, do you think he can care for our little tiny sprained ankles or headaches or whatever we might be afflicted with? We can trust him and know that he is sovereign and he can handle all the little things in our life. He can do it on a global scale, but he can also do it on a personal level. So we can worship him and we can praise him for not only his sovereign hand, but the fact that we belong to him and he's going to care for us and he has a plan for us. And part of that plan was given to us in the Sunday school hour to share with those that will go through this period of time unless they trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. And it may be that if they've rejected the truth now, they will have that strong delusion and there may not be a second chance. So our encouragement is to take our brother's advice and share the gospel with as many people as we can. So let's close in praise of our Lord.